which is overwhelmingly popular. The pro-Russian Georgian Dream Party won, but evidence is abundant that the vote was rigged with help from Russia. Georgia's prime minister has decided to delay by 4 years its application to join the EU, despite the fact that Georgia's constitution stipulates that the country's goal is to join it. The opposition continues to hold massive demonstrations and a boycott of parliament, enabling Georgian Dream to elect a president hostile to the West, while the sitting president insists she will not leave office, saying the government is illegitimate. A government crackdown is underway. Masked government agents hauled away a leader of the opposition in full view of journalists. And in Romania, the first round of a presidential election was voided by judges of the Constitutional Court after the winner, Kelin Georgescu, a far-right political unknown who polled 1% on November 5th, emerged with 23% on November 26th. The court cited declassified intelligence documents that detailed allegations of Russian influence operations on social media, mainly TikTok, which nearly half of all Romanians use. Georgescu admires Putin and parrots the Russian line on NATO and Ukraine. He has many times questioned NATO's value in providing security for Romania. He will face Elena Lasconi, the pro-Europe candidate of the ruling Social Democratic Party, in a new election. Pro-European parties hold two-thirds of the seats in parliament, and they have formed a grand coalition to counteract the pro-right trend in Romanian politics. Next, in France. The president, Emmanuel Macron, may have thought he had outfoxed the left and right back in September when he called a snap National Assembly election in which his centrist party came in third. But when the left and right couldn't agree on a candidate for premier, Macron appointed Michel Barnier. After only 3 months, Barnier was forced to tender his resignation after a no-confidence vote in the Assembly, the first such defeat for a French government since 1962. Macron has installed another centrist, François Bayrou, to replace Barnier, but he faces the same problem Barnier had, gaining approval of a budget to cover France's huge deficit. Continued political deadlock seems certain. What to make of these five cases? In three of them, public outrage and legal means have confronted abuses of power, but not ended it. Putin is still Korea's president, Macron remains in charge in France, and a pro-Russian leadership is running Georgia. Romania's pro-Europe democracy is uncertain. Only Brazil's Lula is firmly in command. Which brings us to us. As David French writes in the New York Times, quote, "We have long trusted presidents not to abuse their power, and most presidents have proven worthy of that trust. Trump is not. While we can hope that the courts and Congress will restrain him in his second term, American law gives him more power than he should rightfully possess. So yes, it can happen here. Will the U.S. follow the trend of democratic backsliding? All three branches of government are in Trump's hands, and there are no saviors on the horizon." I'm Mel Gartoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eliza Yurkov and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegedoff, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go now to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in depth. where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Artie Wall. Later this week, Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the sidewalk shooting of the CEO of United Healthcare, will face an extradition hearing. He's facing murder charges in New York, but is currently being held in Pennsylvania. The shooting spawned a lot of online dialogue and illuminated the contrast between how we think about street crime compared to corporate crime. Anthony Rosso is a Rutgers University professor and the author of the book Dual Justice, America's Divergent Approaches to Street and Corporate Crime. He spoke with KBOO's Eliza Yurkov.
I guess to start out, how do you feel about the serendipity of the book coming out a day before the United Healthcare shooting?
There's a lot of obvious things that line up here. So I think the punchline of the book itself is that in America, we've historically understood harmful conduct very differently depending basically on who commits it and where and how it manifests. Basic idea that a shooting on the street, we're going to define and treat as a crime. Personal failings that warrants punishing them severely, but that we define harm caused in corporate boardrooms as these kind of inevitable byproducts of business decision-making and things that are just facts of life we have to live with. They end up not getting criminalized, but regulated by all sorts of regulatory systems that we have that are kind of designed to monitor what we would call harmful corporate conduct through administrative rules rather than punishment. So on its face, something like gun violence and profit maximization, even if it's done ruthlessly, right? Those two things seem really far apart, but it's, to borrow your word, yeah, it feels serendipitous because the reaction of the public to the murder of Brian Thompson and how cynical it's been and the sort of cold indifference, sort of mocking jokes people have made online and everything, it kind of reflects a public that's sort of reckoning with this reality that a shooting and a denial of medical coverage are both very American forms of violence. And one is a crime and we rationalize the other as reasonable commerce. It just happens to be the case that this murder is bringing those contradictions to light in a powerful way.
So the shooting for me brought up the first days of Occupy Wall Street, where it was the first time in my life, albeit I was a teenager, where the, quote, system was pinpointed as single digestible issue instead of people vaguely gesturing into the air why poverty and oppression exist. And there was a loud enough movement that named something specific to fix, to have action around. And similarly with the murder, it felt like it really brought into focus the healthcare system and the horrors it wreaks upon American citizens. That in juxtaposition with how the nation witnesses crime, let's say a murder, and someone gets convicted, there's a history of celebration, that there's a victory, that society has won, that it's secured its safety and it's returned to normal. We're having both of those kind of phenomena happen at once, where we have this large movement behind this event, the shooting, and then we also have this crime of murder where someone has been caught, we have a singular individual criminal. Can you speak to that convergence and what happens when they happen together?
The convergence of these two things, the shooting itself, which people have been, like I said, having that sort of cold indifference over, like, well, hey, the denial of healthcare coverage is violent too, so why should we care about the violent shooting of this guy, right? That sort of dark response, right, is one thing. And then on the other side, the fact that denials of medical coverage are perfectly legal if done within regulatory constraints, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, highlights a few things, most notably, right, that the way we treat what we would call crime and the way we regulate flaws in our political economy both kind of just reflect and reinforce deeper social, structural, political, economic problems. Right. So we tend to say, oh, crime is this individual level pathology. Let's just punish people, throw them behind bars. We'll try to rehabilitate them if we can. And then if we, you know, send them back into communities that are where they systematically have no chance to really succeed, and we find themselves back in the prison systems, we say, oh, well, I guess you're just a failure. We have to lock you up even harder now.
Mm.
Kind of perpetuates this cycle of poverty, systematic disadvantage, and crime and punishment, right? It just kind of keeps going and going and going. And then on the other side, right, the sort of flaws of the healthcare industry, like I was saying, right, we tend not to criminalize the sort of abuses and harms, I guess, that are inflicted, by major industries like that. We put them through regulations, right? As long as you're following the rules set by federal and state regulatory agencies, you're fine. But what that does, right, is it basically creates a framework in which if you do certain kinds of things, it's considered tolerable or permissible, right? The idea being, right, I think a perfect example, right, is the Affordable Care Act. You were talking about, you know, Occupy Wall Street and all the stuff back then, right? That's when I was starting to do my research on a lot of this, right? And, you know, there's a lot of things that happened in response to Occupy Wall Street, but around the same time, we get the Affordable Care Act, 2010, right? And one of the things that does is it says, right, insurance companies can't deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions. And that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Great accomplishment. But what does that end up doing? That just means that companies can still, right, deny life-saving medical coverage to people and send them into crippling, devastating debt as long as they're doing it inclusively, right? As long as you include people who have life-threatening illnesses, right? You can keep sending people into debt as long as you're kind of doing it with the right forms and right paperwork and you're following the right rules when you do it.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think that the juxtaposition of these two things kind of highlight that the way we treat both of these kinds of harms are very deeply rooted and end up just kind of supporting these really deep inequalities we have in our economy. And I think that's a real source and a point of a lot of the simmering outrage that people have.
Do you think the response to Thompson's murder is like a sign that our social structure and the way that we think about crime is changing at all?
I would like to think that it's an inflection point in some ways, and in other ways it's hard to be too optimistic, right?
Right.
I'll sort of give both sides of this perspective, right? And is it an inflection point? Maybe. So if you look online and you follow the sort of grim public response to everything, right? It's certainly been people on, you know, all sides of the political spectrum on board with this, right? And you know, I'm just talking purely about the very dark public reaction, right? Obviously, what Luigi Mangione is alleged to have done is violence and should not be condoned. I'm talking purely about the public reaction to it.
Right.
But public reaction has been left and right. You know, I was reading something the other day about a lot of right-wing commentators who posted videos that were basically saying, oh, look at how the left's reacting to the murder of the CEO, how horrible. And a lot of the comments on those videos, right, I think it was maybe, I forget the name, I think it was Ben Shapiro and one other right-wing commentator, the comments on their videos were like, oh, you don't get it. Like, we too are upset. Like, we also don't really have any sympathy for this guy, right? So there is a sense that people all over kind of feel this anger and outrage, which in some sense is promising, right? That at least in the realm of healthcare, maybe there's this acknowledgement that something systematically is broken.
Right. It's a bipartisan issue.
Right. It's that the identification of the problem, right, is shared, right? What the solution is, I'm sure, is obviously going to be very different depending on where you sit.
Right.
Universally agreed that this is a problem and something's deeply fundamentally broken. The reason for obviously being so optimistic that this is an inflection point is, right, that we just kind of elected, right, a president who very perfectly embodies, right, a lot of these contradictions.
Right.
When I you know, talk about my research and, you know, how these two different approaches are related and reflect these inequalities in the political economy and have kind of developed over time, right? It's something that, you know, all sides have participated in equally. Both sides of the political aisle have participated in and embraced these ideas. Right? Donald Trump very much embodies them, right? He's you know, very much endorsed and called for, you know, harsh law and order politics, locking people up. Obviously, I don't need to, you know, repeat all of those things, right? We've heard him say it so many times. And then on the other side, when confronted with evidence of you know, his own wrongdoing, you know, I think the 2016 presidential debate was a real telling thing, right? He's talking partially about, you know, crackdown on law and order, and Hillary Clinton says something to the effect of, you know, the tax returns you've shown have released are very few, but they've shown you haven't paid taxes, and he goes, oh, well, that makes me smart, right? Something that's kind of bending the rules. I'm not a criminal and deserves the harsh law and order I want for everybody else. It's, you know, it's what makes me a savvy business person. So he kind of very much embraces those ideas. I have a hard time believing that it's going to, the sentiment people are feeling is going to drive some bigger systematic change given the direction politically the country seems to be going right now.
Right. I was curious about that, where, you know, he received the popular vote, and yet he's a convicted felon. And so I was curious about your opinion or your understanding if that, I mean, I'm guessing it's both, but if this is a way for Americans to reckon with their attitudes around crime by electing a criminal, and if it's just a kind of deepening of the way that we think about corporate crime and how we might, I guess, like look up to those who have enough power and money to bend the rules rather than a change in the way that we think about crime.
Right. Yeah, I think that last part is what sticks out to me, is sort of how we look up to people who have the power to kind of bend the rules and shape it in their favor. Because when I think about Donald Trump specifically embodying these sorts of ideas, right, he has his criminal convictions on the record. I'd have to go through every single one again. I'm not sure if all of them are related exactly to sort of corporate financial crime, and which ones are and which ones aren't, and whether or not they sort of fall into different categories of crime, because I know that there was, how many were there again? So I don't want to speak directly to those too much, but the point you made there at the end, that people kind of look up to those, that kind of person, is fundamental to driving the kind of inequalities I've been talking about, right? So when I look in my research historically, a lot of these ideas originated, you know, over a century ago with essentially what was, you know, I'll try not to get too in the weeds, but essentially the American eugenics movement, right? Over, you know, late 1800s, eugenics was basically the idea that certain people were genetically superior to others. Let's make sure that they're the ones reproducing and that the defectives aren't. And the punchline is, eugenicists said criminals were born to be criminals. They deserve to be locked up or sterilized or something even worse. But they said, you know, the robber barons of the, you know, the late 19th century, the people leading the big oil companies and all them, they might be doing stuff that hurts you, but that's just because they have this sort of genetically superior entrepreneurial spirit. Makes them so competitive. And they're just naturally really smart and savvy and ruthless, and that's what makes them so good at business, right? And these are these very old established ideas that kind of shaped how we think about these two kinds of crime and how we respond to them. And, you know, you look throughout history, obviously, you know, the latter half of the 20th century, eugenics isn't exactly as popular as it was, right? World War II. But Donald Trump himself is very much on board on explicitly embracing eugenic rhetoric, right? A couple months ago, he gave an interview where he said, I think murder, it's in the murderer's genes. In The Art of the Deal, he says, I think deal-making's in your genes. He's totally on board with this idea. And a lot of the people who look, you know, who support him and are enthusiastic about him, look at some of the things he's done and say, right, yeah, I do think that tax evasion is just because he's a smart, savvy businessman. He's good at this stuff, right? So there is this sense of looking up to or admiring, right, that sort of ruthless robber baron character. Looking at the election of Donald Trump, I think there is a certain degree of perpetuating those ideas by electing someone who embodies that, and who's also espousing really severe, harsh criminal justice rhetoric at the same time.
Right. It's confusing to hear the way he speaks and then to witness his actions and to understand and dig through what that reflects about American culture. And going into the history of eugenics, it's... yeah, it's hard to parse out that kind of hierarchy and who, quote, belongs at the top. But then there's also this sense of, like, earning your position at the top by, you know, the kind of bootstraps mentality, working hard, and we see that as a virtue as well. Yeah, can you speak more to that history and those, and how those values get kind of mixed around with each other?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think they both kind of emerged, right? Like I was saying, like that idea that, you know, criminality was a trait and being good at business was a born trait, right? They emerged in a much larger context in which eugenics was unfolding, right? Different inequalities were being justified, right? That immigrants were inferior, that people of color were inferior, that the poor were inferior, all this other stuff. But what it kind of ended up doing was it ended up basically saying, right, or being interpreted as saying, right, junk science, but widely believed at the time to be very legitimate science.
Right, right.
But it was widely believed, among many other things, as basically naturalizing our class inequality, our class system, right? That the class inequality, the class system we have is the way it is because of people's nature, right? It's naturally going to unfold that way, right? You put down two people, you take them, one person's, I'm quoting these, you know, kind of system way back when, you take a pauper, you take a poor person, you take a millionaire, you take away all their monies, you pop them down in the desert island, and they're just going to be right back where they were again in 1 year, right? That was the kind of belief.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And people looked to things like poverty and racial inequality, and they linked all of that stuff, right, to criminality, right? So that even if you hadn't committed a crime at the time, they said, okay, you're poor, okay, you're black, okay, you're an immigrant. Well, that to me suggests that you probably have the same disposition that causes crime too, right? So it kind of emerged when it was sort of used to stigmatize criminality in this way. It basically emerged as a way to say that our class system is totally natural,
right?
Right, and sort of uphold it and legitimize it over time, right? So when you look at what happens historically, to get to your question about what happens, what's the history here, right? Yeah, eugenics kind of fades from influence, right? Especially following World War II, right? The scope of the Nazi eugenicide, right? Obviously, you know, after that point, American eugenics was very hard pressed to find explicit, you know, funding and then things like that. But those ideas kind of get repurposed, and they kind of shift around in different ways, right? So a lot of the features of our criminal justice system, I argue, right, actually have their origins or their basis in developments that happened during the eugenics era.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the features of modern justice systems, right, is something called indeterminate sentencing. Basically the idea that, you know, you get a prison sentence, but it's usually a range. And then a parole officer, can watch how you reform behind bars and, you know, give you opportunities to release early. So it's up to prison administrators to say, hey, you've reformed, or no, you haven't, we're going to hold you longer. And, right, we think of that as a pretty good thing, and it offers the benefit of having people release early. That's great, but in its origins, it was very closely tied to eugenics when it first came into being, because the idea was people who reform aren't criminal by nature, we can reform and release them again. But the people who don't reform, we can use this indeterminate sentence to contain them for as long as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't think of it as having this origins, but it actually does, right? Or, you know, different features of our modern justice system, right? The fact that we rely on criminal history so severely, right? Every country uses criminal history to punish people, but in other nations in Western Europe and the rest of the world, they, you know, it's very limited how much criminal history can impact a sentence. Whereas in the United States, you have these, you know, these three strikes laws that, you know, these stories about someone who steals from a you know, a Walmart three times and goes to prison for life. We don't see that in other countries, right? Our reliance on criminal history is because we long interpreted that as evidence of someone's innately criminal disposition. So the idea being that even though eugenics isn't as popular anymore, if we want to look at the big stretch of history when eugenics kind of goes away, we have these sort of relics in our legal system that stick around that actually keep those eugenic principles kind of alive, even without the kind of explicit, offensive, gross eugenics ideas backing it, right? Even though they're not around anymore, those kind of assumptions kind of stick around, if that makes sense.
Definitely. And that's making me think of a kind of classic American tale of someone being born in poverty and taking charge of their life and becoming, you know, an expert or an exceptional individual in their field. I'm thinking Martha Stewart, and kind of specifically her, because she was this American success story where she came from a family where, you know, she was living on a small acreage, not a lot of wealth to her, and then she grew this huge brand. She completely bought into and shaped American culture with her success, and then she's charged with this white collar crime, with this corporate crime of insider trading. And we take that as this failure that she didn't get away with it, maybe. I'm curious what you think about those these like American success stories kind of shaping the way we think about American culture and about Americans with our individual exceptionalism, and how those stories might be changing our cultural attitudes about crime in the future.
Right. So basically, like I guess you're thinking about like the sort of pick yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yes.
Sort of narrative, so to speak.
Yes. That you don't have this fate, you know, this like how do you see us, I guess a more direct question is, do you see us moving away from these eugenic relics just by the way of stories coming out about how they're simply not true?
I mean, again, something I would like to think, I'm not sure that the two ideas can't coexist, though, because a lot of the sort of eugenic procedures that evolved were intentionally meant to kind of sort, right? Here are the people that are defective, here are the people that aren't. Let's kind of sort them into these two categories so that we can treat them appropriately. You can certainly look back at eugenicists who also, you know, believed that there were people who could pick them up by their pick themselves up by the bootstraps and succeed. It was just that, you know, if you had two poor people and one did that and one didn't, it was just interpreted as proof, right, of what you were.
I see. And so you could kind of continue that eugenics argument that, well, the person who picked them up by their bootstraps had the bootstraps gene or something.
Right. They had the capacity to do it. The other person was lazy and then didn't, right? That's how a lot of eugenicists kind of interpreted class divisions at the time. And there were other variations on how they interpreted and upheld that contradiction in ways that I don't think would, you know, hold much sway today, involving different theories in eugenics thinking. But the punchline, right, is that, yeah, they were able to hold those contradictory beliefs because they believed that there was this sort of sorting process that needed to happen. Who was worthy? Who was unworthy? Right? We can throw them out into the market world of competition and see who succeeds and who doesn't, right? And that'll just naturally kind of show us who's okay and then who's defective. We have those pick yourselves up by the bootstraps narratives. Obviously, they're still very powerful today in American political culture, but we still have the same problem where when someone fails, we just kind of say, well, that's on you. And, you know, the crime example is certainly part of that, right? You give someone, you know, who's behind bars a, you know, an education or job training, and then you release them to community where they have absolutely no opportunities to use any of those new skills. And then they re-enter the system and we just kind of say, oh, well, how are we going to interpret this?
Right.
Something must be wrong with you, right? We kind of so focus on reforming the individual that we fail to understand the sort of underlying systemic issues. We kind of gloss over that. It goes back to the point I was kind of saying before, that it just sort of perpetuates that cycle of inequality, and poverty and crime, and keeps them all together.
Yeah, is there anything we can do to help change the cultural tide so we are at least a little more compassionate towards one another?
So I think, right, in terms of the cultural tide, I think that's actually probably the part that, you know, I think there's more of a shift towards, because there is a bipartisan, like I said, acknowledgement that, hey, this system isn't working. I think that there's actually been a lot of attention on shifting popular understandings of those ideas that could be fruitful for further discussion, and not being afraid to kind of talk about those class divisions, right, and how they manifest in something like healthcare, and not being afraid to talk about them publicly and in the media and address it, because I think sometimes talking about class inequality almost comes across as a little taboo in the United States. Like, mm-hmm. American exceptionalism, we don't have that, but we do, and I think people are starting to come to terms with that. The bigger obstacle I see is just purely politically, sort of our institutions are so durable, so hard to change, right? And I look at something like, you know, the case we, you know, we're talking about here, right, with Brian Thompson. I mean, a lot of the analysis I provide in my own work kind of says we punish one form of crime and we regulate the other forms of harmful conduct. But look at the healthcare industry, right? I'm not convinced that any combination of punishment or regulation is going to really address the problems there. I think punishment's just going to, you know, fix it at the margins, get rid of a few bad, unscrupulous, you know, CEOs or whatever. Regulation is just going to kind of create this framework in which this unjust system continues to function, right? Like I said before, you can just deny coverages as long as you sign the right papers when you do it. And I think it highlights, again, that these things support a fundamentally unfair and unequal political economy. What would really fix the healthcare industry, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
seeing it as a fundamental right, a thing, something that should be governed as a public good to the whims of the private market actors who are motivated by profit maximization, right, instead of patient care. To me, the bigger obstacle is in the political and institutional realm. I think that, if anything, our political culture is becoming more and more aware of kind of these class inequalities. In some sense, that's what's been driving some of our politics for the past, 10 years. That's been a current that's been there, and something motivating, right? The popularity of someone like Bernie Sanders, and then the supporters of Donald Trump seem to see him as someone who, I guess, they think will stand up for the little guy against big corporate America. I'm not certain of that.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for having this discussion with me. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to chat with us, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks so much. I appreciate the chance to talk.
That was Rutgers University professor Anthony Grosso, the author of the new book, Dual Justice, America's Divergent Approaches to Street and Corporate Crime. He spoke with KBOO's Eliza Yurkov. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Marty Wall. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we bring you a range of community-oriented programming built by community members like you.
Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st.